Bible study.
No, it's not dance.
We could dance, but actually that last song that was just opening, that was a greeting song in Swahili, where it gives the greetings like, good morning, and so forth. So it's a nice way to open up this Bible study session, which is part of a week's journey through some of the passages in the Hebrew Scriptures in the Old Testament that have to do with diversity. And today we're going to concentrate on the figure of Hagar. Now, central, of course, in the Scriptures is the Exodus from Egypt, where the Israelites are freed from slavery and they go on to enter a covenant relationship with God. That remains central, you know, beginning in Exodus and then all the way through Deuteronomy, and it's referred to in the Psalms and throughout the rest of the Bible, the prophets. But we also have in the Bible glimpses of other people's journey to freedom and to authentic relationship with God. And so Hagar is the figure that we're going to look at today. A character. She's an Egyptian slave of Abraham and Sarah. Now that's an interesting point to ponder. Mm-hmm. When you think about, you know, Egyptian slavery, this is actually an Egyptian slave. And we're going to talk about Hagar, her story, and also the legacy that she leaves, right, as the mother of Ishmael, which the Arab people and Muslims in particular identify as the ancestor of the Arabs, and a very important figure in Islam. And so we have Abraham as the father of faith of at least three different peoples, and so very rich figure. Just get a jump start. Yesterday we looked at the Tower of Babel and considered it as a story not of pride and punishment, but as a story of the cradle of civilization in Babel. Concentrating a bit on the ziggurats, if you remember. And this is that ziggurat, or that preeminent human-made mountain reaching the sky, that place where heaven and earth meet and the gods reside on the top. This is the one in Ur, which is where Abraham is from, if you recall. Ur of the Chaldeans. And the ziggurat in Ur is the best preserved of the 26 or so that we have. So because I don't have any pictures of Hagar, I have to resort to maps instead. But just to give us a little bit of a orientation, here's Ur, down here, the Persian Gulf here, Ur. And we had been talking about Babylon, which is right there. This is the Tigris and the Euphrates. And people ask, well, where is Shinar, the plain of Shinar, where Babel, where the people settled? And that is between the plain between the Tigris and the Euphrates. So just to orient yourself a bit. So we're talking about here. Today we're talking about Abraham and his travels and his family with attention to Hagar. And his own story begins with a journey as well. Remember the Tower of Babel story, or the City of Babel story that we studied, ended with a scattering of the people in all directions. And Abraham's story in Genesis 12 is a close-up view at a journey. And journeys during this time were very common. We have evidence of migrations from various places, of peoples up and down, the Hurrians, the Hittites, the Amorites. So this is a time of mass migration, perhaps similar to our own time. And Abraham's own journey goes from Ur, you see Ur down there, to Haran. So his whole family moves to Haran, settles there for quite a while. And then in chapter 12, he's called to leave his family's homeland and to go to a land that God will show him. So he continues down to Shechem, Hebron, and other places. This, just to give you a little bit of a cultural sense, this is a beautiful piece of artwork from Ur, where Abraham was from 2000 BC. So it's really old. It's from a king called Ur-Nammu, who was also responsible for the ziggurat. So he had very high culture. And you see the nobles are sitting up above there. The king is there, the bald guy. I don't know if you see my youngest son. I modeled his haircut. And then you see the social stratification, right? You see the herders and the other layers of society that have to labor to maintain these construction projects and the kingship and so forth. But Abraham is and his family leave Ur and go to Haran. And I just give you a few pictures from a contemporary Turkey, from the eastern part of Turkey, of Haran. The traditions about Abraham are very strong in Turkey and in Muslim, primarily Muslim country. This is a tower that's associated with Abraham there in Haran. According to the later Jewish tradition and also in Muslim tradition, Abraham became a monotheist when he was looking at the stars. So we have a chance, not tonight, I don't know, it's pretty cloudy, but to recreate that sense of wonder. Abraham came to know God as one by looking at the vastness of creation and understanding that there must have been one creator. So this is a picture of the observatory there that's associated with this moment in the history of faith, where Abraham becomes a monotheist in contrast to all the other people of the area. So according to the traditions, Abraham was cast into a fiery furnace because he refused to worship the other gods. We've heard that a lot, right? That sounds like a story from Daniel, doesn't it? But it's put on to onto Abraham. And actually, it's a wonderful play of words because Ur in Hebrew also means fire. So when the Bible says, I'm taking you out of Ur, they developed, the tradition was developed that God also rescued Abraham from the fire. And so this is actually a pool was created to save Abraham. So these are sites, so pilgrimage sites in Turkey associated with Abraham in the Muslim world. Anyway, moving on in our journeys, the green is kind of the area associated with the travels of Abraham and his descendants in the hill country there, Shechem, Bethel, Ai, Jerusalem, Hebron, and so forth. But we have today, as we're going to look at the stories of Hagar, we also have Abraham almost immediately after he's called to leave his home country in chapter 12. There's a famine in the land, and he goes down to Egypt. So an additional layer of travels. And we have tomb in Egypt, we have this picture of Asiatics, or people from the east, going down to Egypt as merchants as early as the 19th century before the Common Era. So this is fascinating. So if Abraham were part of this movement back and forth between the high country of Israel and Judea and down to Egypt, this is a fascinating pictorial glimpse. These are the Egyptians, you see. And these are all the Asiatics bringing animals, and they have an instrument here, and bows and so forth. Anyway, these are just to give you a little bit of a glimpse. Here's a detail of that, where you have the big Egyptian there that they're bringing all the things to. And this is the actual wall, so you can see the quality, unreconstructed. Okay, so we know that there were migrations. We have encounters between cultures. And let me see here what I... Okay. I'll leave it right there. Let's look briefly at chapter 12. Okay, so we have to read briefly this chapter 12, 1 through 2. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing." In Hebrew, it's actually an imperative. Be a blessing. "I will bless those who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of earth shall be blessed." So at the end of Genesis, the story of the tower or city of Babel, remember there was a scattering and all the people went out to all the ends of the land. And here, Abram is also sent out. He is scattered from his homeland and he is to be a blessing of all the families of the earth in his travels. All right, so the thing I want to point out here also in this is that immediately after his travels, there's famine in verse 10. And if you remember, Abraham asks his wife Sarah to please pretend that they're brother and sister so that Abraham won't be killed, and she helps him to stay alive. But there's afflictions on the house of Pharaoh because he's taken Sarah as his wife, apparently, or one of his wives. And notice that what Abraham gets out of this is in 12:16. He asks Sarah, "Say you're my sister so that it may go well with me because of you and that my life will be spared on your account." How does it go well with him? 12:16. "And for her sake, for Sarah's sake, Pharaoh dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female slaves, female donkeys, and camels." Male and female slaves. So maybe that's where Hagar comes from. Anyway, at least he's down in Egypt. And suddenly, in chapter 16, we have the story of Hagar. So let's read that together and consider this. Let's have somebody start reading, and we can just read a verse or volunteer back here. You want to start? Yeah, sure. You looked up.
Yeah.
This is chapter 16, verse 1. 16, yeah. Chapter 16, verse 1. Uh-huh. Maybe we're actually okay. looking up to get the chapter.
Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarah said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." And Sarah mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her.
Okay, good. Yeah, let's take a break there and study that together. Okay, so you have the promise that we looked at in chapter 12, that God was going to make a great nation, but no children. So, what do they do there? They resort to a practice that was apparently not uncommon in the ancient Near East, according to law codes that we have at places in Mesopotamia like Nuzi and so forth, that you could have a surrogate mother. You could use a slave to bear a child. So similar to our practice of adoption or surrogacy or egg donation. I mean, we've kind of gone a little bit
overboard
like the options we have, but if you don't have children, so what are you going to do? And actually, it's portrayed as Sarai's idea, mm-hmm. but Abraham seems very agreeable. And also, we have to note that the culture was polygamous, right? So women would have one spouse, but the man could have several wives. Of course, Solomon was the highest achiever in that, as well as other things. But so this wouldn't be out of the ordinary, actually, in that context. But notice, this is Hagar, the slave girl, and she conceives. This is interesting when she looks, when Hagar, now we see it from the perspective of Hagar finally in 4, right? She's able to conceive, so she looked with contempt on her mistress. What do you make of that? Actually, in the Hebrew, it's, she thought more lightly of her mistress. She was lessened or whatever, yeah. So Hagar has the ability of procreation, right? So she does have something that her mistress doesn't. So although the hierarchy is one way, right? Hagar is a slave, yet she has a power, a certain power that Sarai doesn't have, and so it.
That's a chick thing, right?
That's a chick thing.
You guys don't know as much about that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Anybody?
Any chicks?
So there's definitely jealousy here, right? Yes.
Listen, Sarah in her 70s and Abram in his 80s, and so here this sweet young thing. Why? Of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
70's not so old.
Some dynamics that some of us seem to understand. But anyway, my husband and I think that we took this story too literally and adopting these kids that are like, you know, when we're close to our 70s and 80s. Like, they could do it.
No servants, though, right?
No servants, right?
To help out.
That's the problem. Okay, so, yes.
What should we consider it? Noteworthy that Hagar's given a name even though she's a servant.
Beautiful, I love that. Okay, so Hagar has a name. That's very important. Naming is really important. Notice that even people like the Pharaoh in the Exodus story don't have a name. But Hagar does. Yeah. And what does her name mean? We don't know for sure, but Jewish tradition, Hagar means the sojourner, the one who dwells with. And you know, you're supposed to treat the sojourner well, right, and protect them and so forth. But yes, she actually has a name. And do Abraham and Sarah ever call her by name? This is an interesting thing. Look, let's scan through. From 16:1-6, what do they call her? The narrator, right? The one who's telling the story, the voice of the story. An Egyptian slave girl whose name was Hagar. Yeah. So yes. Yeah, so Sarah calls her slave girl. The narrator, notice, keeps saying Hagar the Egyptian, her slave girl. So Hagar, the name. and then the ethnicity, and then the fact that her social status within the family. But they Sarah and Abraham do not call her Hagar, my slave girl. So
the
it's just
angel will later.
The angel will later. They recognize her by name. Yeah, that's both the narrator and the angel. So they give her the dignity of a name, of an identity, right? And address her by name. So that's a beautiful thing. So already Sarah and Abraham are discounting her personhood, it seems, in that. And then when Hagar becomes pregnant, then she, you know, has some more self-esteem, right? More status. But in the end, Abram is not going to get into that, right? As you say, your slave girl is in your power. Do with you as you please. And then here's a sad line. Sarai dealt harshly with her. So, and she ran away, so harshly that she ran away. So this is the first narration of Hagar's departing the family. And in this case, leaving because of the harsh treatment. A rather sobering and realistic view of Abraham and Sarah, Abraham and Sarai's family here. But let's go on here. We have another reader. Any other comments about this section, the dynamics? Or let's go on to make a little bit tracks. If you're volunteering.
Well, the only thing I can think of is Sarah's idea, but she blames Abraham. Man always has a problem.
So do you recognize some marital dynamics and all this?
Do you have a reader?
Yes, yes.
From what
you can just go ahead and read from 7 on to 15. Yeah.
That's where my finger was.
Okay, excellent, very good.
The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on their way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, slave girl of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I am running away from my mistress, Sarai. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. The angel of the Lord also said to her, I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, now you have received and shall bear a son, and you shall call him Ishmael, for the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He shall be as a wild ass of a man. So, can we skip that one?
We'll come back to
that. Yeah, we'll get back to
that. I didn't see that before. With his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he shall live at odds with all his kin. So she named the Lord. She named the Lord.
Wow, yeah, you stumbled on it. She named the Lord. She's the only person in the whole Bible who names the Lord, yes.
That's probably why I stumbled.
What?
So she named the Lord who spoke to her, you are Elroy. I have a friend called Elroy.
I know. You know that God's a southerner, Elroy.
Elroy has a translation, doesn't it?
Elroy, God of my seeing.
My seeing.
She saw God.
Well, she said, have I really seen God and remained alive after seeing him? Therefore, the well was called, I can't see these notes here.
Bear
Lahai
Roi.
It lies between Kadesh and Bered. Hagar bore Abram, here we go, a son. And Abram named his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael.
Thank you so much for your reading and also for your pauses. Those are really great. Those are places we'll come back to. So isn't it interesting in 15, Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abraham named his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Then Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. I mean, it's Hagar. She's the important character here, right? Okay, great. So let's go back to 7 and see. So we have the angel of the Lord. So often, the angel, it's a messenger. It may not even, probably not even recognizable as an angel, didn't have wings or anything at this time, you know, because in chapter 18, these three angels or messengers come, and Abraham doesn't realize that they just have an appearance of a person. So, but often someone who is playing the role, the divine role here. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water. Interesting. So she's in the desert, in the wilderness, on the way to Shur. Now, where is Shur? Shur is the boundary of Egypt. So she's going home. She's heading back home, but she's having to go through the desert and sitting by a spring there. This is one of the best lines in the whole in the scriptures, I think. And the angel says, "Hagar, slave girl of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" Isn't that an interesting question? I mean, we could ask that of each other, right? Where have you come from and where are you going? In telling our stories, you know, as I heard that session, where have you come from and where are you going? Well, what does she answer? She says, "I'm running away from my mistress Sarah." That's all she says. So she's running from something. She doesn't have the complete narrative yet, right? She knows where she's coming from, but it's from a place of fear, a place of harshness and so forth. And she does it seems like, you know, she doesn't say, "I'm going back to Egypt to my family," or "I'm going," you know, she seems to have no plan or no future in the wilderness. And so here's a line that complicates the history of salvation, right? As Elsa Tamez says, "The angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit to her.'" So you usually think of God as the liberator of slaves, right, in the Egyptian narrative, the one who takes the side of the oppressed and the enslaved. But here, the instruction is to return to your mistress and submit to her. That's interesting that just the mistress, the status is given, submit to her.
How much did that verse get used in our country then as one of the foundation verses for slavery?
For slavery, exactly. Wow. That's right.
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear it.
Could you repeat that excellent observation?
How much did this verse get used then in our country as one of the slavery foundation verses?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the Bible and passages such as this were used in our own country to legitimate slavery, enslavement of Africans. Yes? Mm-hmm.
Well, didn't Paul tell Onesimus to go back to his master too?
Yeah.
But he told the master to be good.
To be good to him. And if we read in 1 Peter, from where our verse is this summer, you know, the many colored grace of God, if you read more, I'm just reading, it talks about the slaves should submit to their masters, especially if they're cruel, harsh, and unjust, because, you know, if they're just being beaten for something that they did, there's no merit, but if they can be like Christ to suffer, you know, unjustly. Oh, so that's also in our scriptures, something that is a seed, you know, that calls for us to interpret with care. Danger, we put a danger, interpret with care here. Now how does a womanist or an African-American biblical scholar interpret a passage such as this? So that might be of interest to us here. And there's a womanist scholar named Dolores Williams, and she wrote a book called Sisters in the Wilderness. And she actually takes Hagar as one of the central characters for her own theology, her own womanist study of the Bible. And she says that Hagar's situation is similar to the situation of African-American women in many cases, that the primary goal is not liberation at any cost, but being in relationship with African-American men, the children, community, and so forth. Rather than freedom, like absolute freedom, the value is survival and quality of life. You do whatever you need at that time to survive and have a quality of life for yourself, but for your whole community, both the women and the men and the children in the whole community. And she says, well, at this point, you have Hagar sitting in the desert by a spring. She's got to have water, but there are not that many springs around. You can't really walk too well from spring to spring. You probably need some kind of animal or, you know, to carry extra water. So she's sitting by a spring. To the question, you know, where have you come from, where are you going? All she says is, I'm running away. She doesn't seem to have a plan. She's going to die. And is the wilderness a place to have a child? No, you need care when you have a child, and the child's not going to make it out there in the middle of nowhere either. So Dolores Williams looks at this story as a story of the embeddedness, right, of human life, and how sometimes you have to not choose perhaps like your absolute highest ideal, but whatever it takes to survive and have a quality of life. And so she does go back, and
it appears that initially Sarah and Hagar had a good relationship. She was chosen to be the wife for Abram. And it was only after she became pregnant and started saying, wow, hey, I'm better than I thought, that relationship started to disintegrate. So maybe, I mean, there's something that she put into that situation that changed that and brought on the persecution of Sarah.
That's certainly Sarah's perception. Now, we could also look at it and say, what choice did Hagar have
to be a slave,
yeah, or to be
the mother?
Yes. Is this a kind of rape? Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Exactly.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Uh-huh. It strikes me that probably she had very little say, and the resentment comes just as much from her side,
sure,
of having been raped, being called a wife when she had no consent in this situation, and then probably likely to lose her child.
Taking it from her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
To
being mm-hmm. Sarah's, and mm-hmm. so the resentment goes both ways. That just
sure.
relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
thank you.
And then she's really then a runaway slave
mm-hmm.
when this person, Angel, meets her and says, what are you doing? I recognize you. Aren't you the slave of Sarah? I go back and submit.
Oh.
I mean, if you just look at it, and you take the interpretation off,
mm-hmm.
in some ways it sounds that way too.
You know, that child is not hers either, nor does she feel that. She's not protecting that child, she's protecting herself, I think.
What, when she's running?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
does that seem, because, I mean, that child's going to die in the desert, like you say.
Mm-hmm. Well, she does end up going back.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And she's protected here interesting. Let's just read these promises. This is the only woman in the Hebrew Scriptures that receives these promises of building a nation and a blessing of her offspring. You think of Abram, he receives this kind of message, right? Or you think of other of the patriarchs. So this is really quite amazing. That's an Egyptian slave woman who gets this message. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted from multitude. Doesn't that sound like Genesis 15 and in Genesis 17, where Abraham's promised, you know, your descendants will be as numerous as the sands on the sea or the stars in the heaven. But now this woman, she's the only woman to receive this kind of promise. And also, she receives this kind of announcement of birth. You have conceived and shall bear its son. Sounds like the Magnificat. And you shall call him Ishmael. Ishmael. Ish in Hebrew means man. And Ishmael. Actually, I'm sorry. Ishmael. It means El, which is God. God hears. God hears. So he has, Ishmael has a name that refers to God's hearing. And we'll see, that's developed later in chapter 20 as well. Okay, so you'll call him Ishmael. Ishmael, God hears. And I probably have a note there that says that, if you have notes. God hears. For the Lord has given heed to your affliction. So that's fascinating too. God heeds Hagar's affliction as he heeds the Israelites in Egypt. Now this part, he shall be a wild ass of a man. Now there's kind of a, you get this enunciation. It's like, he shall be a wild ass of a man. Is that a compliment? No. Is she happy? Oh, good. It's sort of derogatory, right? The you can periodom, it can also mean it can mean wild ass of a man, but periodom can also mean a man of the steppe, or you know, the like the plain, like he's going to live outside of society. So the tribal nature of the Ishmaelites, you know, that they don't live in cities, that they live in tents, and they're traveling and so forth. It can be, and actually asses are not bad. Right? I mean, to us it's like a kind of a insult, right? Insult word. But asses were great animals that were very durable, and we should probably call them donkey or something, but that's still, it has very negative connotations for us, right? But they're very hardy animals, and they can do a lot of work. And here he's a wild one, though, living off, you know, from civilization. In the steppes, his hand against everyone, and everyone a hand against him. He shall live at odds with all his kin. So I guess this is the reputation of the Ishmaelites as seen from an Israelite perspective, as being outside, you know, and being in groups and causing conflicts and so forth. But that's the perspective of those that are settled, right, of the people that are outside.
Who's the kin? Is it the, you know, because this is an Egyptian mother.
Mm-hmm. Egyptian mother. Mm-hmm. And Abraham was the father.
Yeah.
So he really has a hybrid identity, doesn't he?
So who will be the kin?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll know that Isaac is his brother, for example. But Abraham goes on and has many, 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 many children with Keturah, the third wife or woman as well. So, you know, what we have here in these stories is we have sort of the ancient anthropology of the origin of different peoples told through the medium of family histories. And so a lot of these names, for example, as we go on, Ishmael becomes not only the name of a person, but of the Ishmaelites. So he stands for all the Ishmaelites, right? And later on, Jacob becomes Israel, and Lot's children are, with his daughters, are Moab and Ammon and so forth. So we have the story of families and the birth of sons, but the sons actually represent whole people. So it's a way of telling a story about how different peoples are closely related. And so the Ishmaelites, according to this story, are very closely related to the Israelites. In fact, they are the firstborn. They're even previous to Isaac and Jacob and the Israelite line. So this is a very close relative. So talk about kin. This is a very close kinship relationship, and even the firstborn of Abraham. Okay, so let's move on here. And Hagar then responds. She named the Lord who spoke to her, "You are El Roi." El, the same word as in Ishmael. El means God. El Roi. Roi means my seeing. God of my seeing. For she said, "Have I really seen God?" Now notice that it's not the messenger anymore. It's so fascinating. There's these theophanies or appearances of God in human form, you know, in like messenger form throughout the Bible. And so she didn't say, "I've seen a messenger of God." She says, "I've seen God. Have I really seen God and remained alive after seeing him?" Because there's this tradition that no one can see God, right? That seeing God, you will die. But then everyone sees God. It's kind of a paradox. But she names him. She's the only person in the Bible who names God. Fascinating. An Egyptian slave girl, Hagar, seeing and naming God. And then they call the well Ber Lahai Roi. Ber means well. Lahai means of the living sea, of one who lived to see. And then it'll tell you where it is. Okay. So she goes back and has that son. Now we have to look at one other story of Hagar, which is kind of a repeat, sort of a redo of this one. And that is in chapter 21. Before we do, does anybody have any comments or questions about this passage that we've read together?
What's her affliction? Is it the abuse or is it the pregnancy or is
her affliction? Okay, yeah. Tell me where that is.
When the messenger comes.
Oh, I think that you mean return to her mistress and submit to her.
No.
Okay.
I'm fighting myself right now.
Okay,
for
sorry.
The Lord has given heed to your affliction.
Oh, to her affliction. Yeah, I think it's because she's been mistreated by Sarai.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's been mistreated by Sarai.
How old do you think Hagar was?
Hagar?
I mean, it doesn't tell us, right? I mean, she could have been like 13.
She could have been 13.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any age, it doesn't give us an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, too, that the angel told Hagar what to name the son, and Abram.
Names the son.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
Uh-huh. So he at least respected her in that way, or how,
uh-huh.
I don't know how that whole conversation
right.
went on.
Pillow talk.
Pillow talk,
yeah.
Okay, that's good. No, thank you. That's really significant, isn't it? And it is sometimes the mothers that name the children, but you could see in this with Abram naming him the same thing, but Hagar was instructed that Abram is accepting his paternity of the child. And you know, confirming what's gone before, right? It's acceptance of whatever you heard about this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for pointing that out. Anything else? Good observations. Yes.
I have always thought that these passages were the basis of the Arab-Israeli current crisis. That there was an infertility problem here, and somehow, who's the legitimate firstborn?
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to that at all?
I think that the Arab-Israeli crisis is just under 100 years old. So I don't see it deeply rooted. Actually, I think the problem here in 21 isn't between Isaac and Ishmael, but it's once again Sarai's problem. And we find Ishmael showing up and bearing his father with Isaac later. There's not a lot of conflict in these stories of except you know at the origins and their separation. So there's a story of separation. But yeah, the Israeli Arab conflict I think is quite recent. But this points to the common origins, you know, of the two peoples and their closeness. Well, anyway, if you don't mind, just because we have only 15 minutes, I want to get to the second passage, but it would be good to talk to you more about that. Anything else? Okay, let's go on.
You know how, like, Jacob's well, other places, you're still a well there?
Oh,
there
yeah.
Still a well.
Okay.
Ensure that you can find her. It's memorialized, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. In Saudi Arabia, there is a well called Zamzam. So, you know, we were talking about how in Turkey there's these Muslim pilgrimage sites. Well, Zamzam in close to Mecca is the well that God actually made appear. It's more closely related, I think, to the second story that we're going to read now. But there's a part of the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, involves running seven times back and forth in sort of observance of Hagar's frantic running, looking for water for her son, and then the Lord makes this stream, this source of water miraculously appear. So that's that sort of the memorial site. It's more memorialized within the Muslim tradition you know, than within the Jewish tradition, just because of the different emphases, as the Arabs see themselves as the descendants of Hagar. Yeah. Okay, well, let's read this different version of what seems to be a similar story, but it's now placed at a later point. And let's get another reader. I guess we need to start at the beginning. It's a little long, but we'll just read through. Would you like to read a little bit, starting at 21?
Sure, I've got the King James Version.
Okay, very good.
And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. And Sarah said, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh at me. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age.
Okay, great. So the meaning of Isaac is he laughs. And so there's all this laughter. God has brought laughter for me. And remember, Sarah laughs before Abraham laughs at the announcement that the child will be born and so forth. And this Isaac is circumcised at 8 days old. And that's still the Jewish custom to circumcise boys at 8 days old as a sign of the covenant. But we should hop back really quickly. I can't leave this off. If you look at chapter 17, 23, we have Ishmael's circumcision years and years earlier. So once again, Ishmael is the firstborn, the eldest son, the one who was alive there when we have the giving of the covenant in 17 with its sign of circumcision, is circumcised at age 13. Fascinating. In 23, then Abraham took his son Ishmael and all the slaves born in his house or bought with his money. So was Ishmael a slave? Interesting. His son. Every male among the men of Abraham's house, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins on that day, as God had said, and Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. I don't know. Guys probably have a stronger reaction to that. And his son Ishmael was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. That very day, Abraham and his son Ishmael were circumcised. So actually, Ishmael is circumcised and becomes part of the covenant community. First, and all the men of his house, slaves born in the house, and those bought with money from a foreigner were circumcised with him. So the whole house. They circumcised. And the practice among some of the surrounding groups for circumcision, it was more of an initiation into manhood. So we have some depictions of circumcision. I won't show them. I'll show you privately afterwards. No, these are drawings from tombs, Egyptian tombs of circumcision of males being initiated into adulthood. So this was probably a different practice. But Ishmael is portrayed as being part of that covenant community long before Isaac was even born. Okay, so let's continue here with the verse 8, and we'll at least be able to read the rest of this. Somebody want to continue for us? Yes, yes.
Verse 8, 21:8. Uh-huh. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be the heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight, because of his son. But God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondswoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondswoman, because he is your seed. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and put it on her shoulder and gave it to the boy, to Hagar, and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. Then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, for she said to herself, "Let me not see the death of the boy." So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called Hagar out of heaven and said to her, What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes and saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt.
Okay, very good. So here, once again, she leaves, but this time she's cast out. What version are you? Do you have the King James, or what do you have? Okay.
It's the one that's in the room.
Okay, so in verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had bore to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. He was Isaacing. He was laughing with him, joking with him. So maybe, you know, it means it's sort of another pun on that word to laugh, Isaac. He was Isaacing with Isaac. So maybe, you know, didn't like that he was parallel. And now, in Islamic tradition, Abraham goes with his son, and they set up Mecca. And as I said, that well that appears for Hagar is commemorated. But here, notice that she thinks that the child's going to die. And once again, in verse 17, God heard the voice of the boy, and once again, Hagar is given the promise that her son will become a great nation, and she is spared, and the boy grows up. As in that earlier promise, he is an archer, and he lives in the wilderness. And he once again, his mother goes back to Egypt, where she's from, and gets a spouse. So here we have in these stories a glimpse at another people's freedom, journey to freedom, and to becoming a great nation. And we have genealogies. As it goes on, there's genealogies of Ishmael. There's 12 princes, and he joins Isaac. Just fast forward here. He joins Isaac in bearing Abraham. If you look at chapter 25, 9, Abraham lives 175 years. He breathed his last, died in a good old age. An old man, full of years, so he's gathered his people. His sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite, east of Mamre. And so I have here an older picture of the Herod the Great built this fantastic building over the tombs of the patriarchs. But you see, Isaac and Ishmael, there doesn't seem to be enmity between those two, and they come together and bury their father at Mamre. So I just find this so amazing that you do have this glimpse of this other people, and there's no, I don't find demonization. There's a recognition that they are people that live outside of society, and that there is conflict but not really a negative view it at all, but rather very close kin and even previous to the Israelites. And certainly very important. Hagar and Ishmael are very important for the history of Islam, which is also our close kin among the religions of the world. So we are pretty much out of time, but we have any other questions, observations,
contributions? What's that photo?
This photo is of the pilgrimage site in Mecca of Islam. And at the center, you have what's called the Kaaba. You see the little black box? And it's one of five pillars of Islam, if you're able in your life, economically or as far as health, to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. And traditionally, this site is viewed as one that Abraham established with his son Ishmael. And part of the pilgrimage, as I mentioned, is to run on a certain day, run back and forth or walk back and forth seven times to replicate Hagar's search for water for her son, for survival. And so Ishmael is a very important figure within Islam, which is one of the three faiths.
So when they're running, is that when they go around?
No, that's just part of the general pilgrimage. So it's a separate day, a separate observance. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Unless there are two scholars with the same name, you are the person who wrote the introduction and study notes in the New Lutheran Study Bible?
Yeah, in Exodus. Uh-huh.
Yeah, for Exodus, yeah. Uh-huh. For anybody who hasn't had a chance to use one of these Bibles, mm-hmm. they are phenomenal. I've gotten the gentleman who did Psalms. I got to take a class with him.
Who is that?
He's good friends with Russell Lardell, who's the dean of our academy in Dallas, and he came down and gave a class. But it's phenomenal. I noticed yesterday when you made the comment about whether it was a challenge but that the comment had been made that it was really because they needed to be diverse so they could take care of the earth, and that was one that was written in the notes by Terrence
Redline. Mm-hmm.
Redline wrote the.
Mm-hmm.
It's
called the Lutheran Study Bible.
Well, the Lutheran Study Bible.
The Lutheran Study Bible.
Into, mm-hmm. a couple of
you might enjoy
ago.
Looking at it. We probably have it in the library, the Holden Library, I would think.
But I just want to let you know, we've been using it, and we just really appreciate all the notes, all the work you guys went to.
Thank you. Well, tomorrow we're going to look at Pharaoh's daughter's adoption of Moses. So we're going to look at an international adoption in the book of Exodus, and as you mentioned, I did do the study notes for the book of Exodus in the Lutheran Study Bible, and I enjoyed reviewing a lot of the material there. I saw a couple of hands. Yes.
I was going to point out that in the story, when God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, mm-hmm. Muslims think this obviously has to be Ishmael. Because that was the son.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the tradition just split there, but the story is
right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's you'll find that there are some of the early traditions actually have Isaac because they're following the Muslims are following the scriptures. But yeah, as it evolves, Ishmael becomes the son who's identified primarily as that son that Abraham. Almost sacrificed, yeah.
When the angel was talking to Hagar and predicting what's going to happen, she says, Ishmael is, everyone's hand is going to be against him and with an odds with his kin. That sounds like a curse.
Well, it may be more of a description from the perspective of the Israelites as their relationship.
So this is the perspective of the author of this text.
I think so. Mm-hmm. That was their experience of these people. One more comment, and then we got to go get some coffee, right?
Yeah. What about the significance of God making all these promises, but at the very beginning when Sarah gives up the Egyptian slave to have the... I mean, that's kind of their deal. The Lord didn't command that. He didn't promise that. And then all of a sudden, the Lord God comes in there and intervenes and says, this is what's going to happen now. Is there a significance between how all those promises came together? Because obviously Sarah must have felt some pressure of their promise to God that they were going to make this nation, but they can't have any kids. And then,
this is such a fascinating point. It's like, to what point do we wait for, you know, God to fulfill the promise? To what extent are we responsible for, you know, taking the first step or whatever? Obviously, things happened. God said no, not through these human means, but it ended up being for good, as the Joseph story, you know, ends up being God uses something that is not perhaps intended or whatever for good, and so you have these great nations, two great nations, seen from Abraham. Well, blessings on your day, and see you tomorrow. Talk about Pharaoh.